Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Charles Waugh. He has just formed a new nonprofit organization called Power Lines, and his intent is to reform the regulatory structure of electric utilities in the United States. Now, there's regulatory commissions in 50 states. He claims that there's about 200 individuals, the commissioners, that are controlling the electric utility industry and its $200 billion worth of electric sales. Really excited to have Charles on the podcast today. Hey, Charles, welcome to the podcast. It's great to meet you and to see you. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Ted. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Tell me, where are you sitting before we get into the meat of the matter?
So I'm based here in Washington, D.C., about a 15-minute walk from the Capitol building. So it's always an interesting time in the city, that's for sure.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, a very interesting time in the city. Well, let's jump into Power Lines. I've already introduced you as the founder and the CEO of Power Lines, a nonprofit that is, as I understand it, you got this focus on regulatory commissions and reforming commissions. And how did you come up with that targeted focus for your nonprofit?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think fundamentally, over the last several years, I've just kept on coming back to this question. How are state public utility commissions and utility regulators so important to everything that we talk about in the energy transition with the grid, with power sector challenges? Yet, you know, folks in the climate and energy space, broadly speaking, until fairly recently, didn't talk about PUCs all that much. Yeah. It was a question that I kept on returning to, anything from, you know, some work that I was doing on building electrification, on IRA implementation, on energy policy, would just keep on coming back to this question of PUCs. And as I dug in further, I kept on realizing that we have a very outdated and broken regulatory model. In some ways, the regulatory infrastructure is aging even faster than our physical infrastructure. And we need more people to pay attention to what's going on here, to the key decision makers that impact how we build out our grid of the future and how we accelerate the energy transition. And that's why we started Power Lines, was to tackle this issue of state public utility commissions and what we could do to make sure that our utility regulatory system was advancing an affordable, reliable, and clean energy future.
That's fantastic. And I know it's not just about money, but in some of the stuff that I read preparing for our conversation, you said there's about 200 people, about 200 commissioners that are basically controlling our utilities, which are doing about $200 billion in annual electricity sales. Is that right?
That's right. 200 public utility commissioners oversee over $200 billion every year in utility spending. And that includes largely CapEx. And that figure doesn't even really consider the full set of operational expenditures that utilities engage in. So that's a lot of money. It's $1 billion a person. And these commissioners have a ton of power, yet people don't know who they are or what they do.
And I hate to ask the question, but do you think that some of them are not really qualified? I mean, this is sort of a kind of under the radar a little bit, right? These are not elected officials. They're appointed, aren't they, generally?
Generally appointed. In about 40 states, they're appointed, usually by the governor, although in the case of North Carolina and Virginia, they're technically appointed by the legislature. And then in the other 10 states, they're elected. It's a good question of what constitutes a qualified commissioner, because it's not just the things that you might think of as the sort of hard skills, the skills on paper, things like technical expertise on utility and utility regulatory issues, or, you know, certainly you have the important qualifications of, ideally, you have a commission that's balanced in terms of legal expertise, accounting expertise, finance expertise, engineering expertise, policy expertise. So those are like the major areas of expertise that commissions generally need to have given the task at hand. That doesn't mean that every commissioner needs to have all of those skills. And I would argue that one of the most important skills that a commissioner needs to have that often gets lost in this conversation about qualifications is an ability to be very thoughtful in asking questions and being an effective regulator and being able to take a more proactive approach to take initiative and leading rather than just sort of presiding. There's a famous utility regulatory scholar named Scott Hempling that has written a lot about this. He has a book called Preside or Lead, and that refers to this notion of whether utility commissioners are just kind of acting as judges and presiding over case versus leading and actually making sure that the public interest is centered in their decision making. And I would argue that that kind of more temperament or disposition question is just as, if not more important than the hard skills that a regulator brings to the table.
Yeah. Now you laid out a whole lot of hard skills and you said not every commissioner has to have every one of these. You want to have a robust commission. You want members to complement one another, much like our California Energy Commission, where I think they have very specific designated. Here's the economist, here's the technical person, here's the this and the that. But I was, Charles, I was going to add to that another dimension is that at least in California, our commissioners are dealing with electricity, natural gas, telecom, which is a very complicated area. In California, railroads, taxi medallions, I'm probably forgetting a few, maybe interstate pipelines. I mean, they have
water utilities as well.
Water as well. Okay. So it's a wide, a big array of resources that you're also looking after. And you'd hope that some of them would have expertise in those specific areas, right?
That's definitely helpful. To be absolutely clear, I think, you know, public utility commissions range from 3 or 5 commissioners in most states, sometimes 7. Certainly with those larger commissions, you're able to have more of that expertise kind of covered. And so I would argue, to your point, it's definitely helpful to have folks with that expertise. But again, I would go back and say that the most important thing is a curiosity and open-mindedness to learn, to ask the tough questions, and to really drive forth and lead and take initiative. And that's something where if you're a commission, you could have all the expertise in electricity and none of the expertise that's needed in water and still be able to make a dent in the water space, for instance. But that's something I think the soft skills that we tend to overlook that I would argue are part of the problem in terms of why we're not seeing more innovative, forward-thinking regulatory bodies.
Right. Well, let's dig into that point. I mean, we're sort of preparing notes for our chat today, I was like, you know, what problem are you trying to solve? We've sort of said that the regulatory structure is backwards. It needs to be reformed. Give me an example of that.
Sure. Well, starting at a macro level, to motivate this problem a little bit, let's think about the moment that we're in right now in 2024. I think it's probably the most interesting time in the facing the U.S. electricity sector or system since its inception. And what I mean by that is we have this convergence of a lot of important trends that are creating pressures on the system. To start, the two bedrock principles of our utility system that we could always take for granted, notably affordability and reliability, this idea that anytime you wanted to flip a switch, you could turn the lights on, and that the bill that you pay at the end of the month is reasonable. Both of those are increasingly fragile and coming to a breaking point. You know, in your backyard of California, electricity rates have increased a significant amount. That's not just a California issue. That's an issue nationally where bills have gone up about 20% nationally since the start of 2022. And the pressures on bills are only going to increase as we are increasingly reliant on gas as a fuel, as an input to our electricity mix. The gas price volatility that we're seeing, particularly following the Russia-Ukraine crisis, is causing a lot of rate increases. Wildfire and other climate risks are driving up utility bills, particularly in California and other states that are prone to wildfires.
Yeah.
And load growth, growing electricity demand. So there's an affordability set of pressures. The reliability pressures are important as well, where we've seen in Texas, for instance, the energy capital of the world struggle with electricity outages that have lasted for days on end, if not weeks, like in Houston just earlier this year with the storm with Beryl, as well as previously with Elliot and Uri. There's been a huge set of challenges facing our grid. And we may not feel it today in the sense that, you know, right now you could still reasonably be paying reasonably affordable bills for reasonably reliable electricity. But there's so many pressures that are masking this kind of underlying fractures that will be soon revealed if we don't do something about this, particularly as we use up more and more electricity for things like artificial intelligence and data centers. But so that's the problem that we're facing, is that the regulatory structure has led us to this point. We are not investing in innovation and in efficiency enough. Yeah. That's what we need to do moving forward.
I used to work for Amory Lovins, as you probably know, and it was all about the soft path. I mean, the soft path was really about, tapping the innovation and tapping this gross, fantastic potential for energy efficiency. So, I mean, just to simplify your thesis here, it's that the commissioners themselves, many of them don't have the soft skills, the leadership skills, the evaluation, kind of the inquisitiveness that's required to see things a little bit differently and to see that we're on a path right now as a country. Like you said, there's more and more wildfires, the natural gas prices are going up. I want to get into decarb and vehicle to grid integration and load growth, but if you had to generalize, they're missing this fundamental need to shift direction. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that's definitely true about the commissions. I would make the point about commissions, unless the commissioners, in part because most commissioners, I would argue, they're generally well-intentioned, generally motivated, generally doing as good of a job as they can. If I had to lay critiques, it would really be on the commissions themselves, the utility regulatory system that's really broken, that doesn't incentivize, for instance, commissioners to be bold and take action. Just on the affordability and reliability piece, I think a lot of commissioners, for instance, are really concerned about reliability and resource adequacy because they don't want to get blamed when the lights go out. They don't want their governors to blame them. And so they're very, very risk averse. But if we figure out how we can create more latitude or space for regulators to embrace a more forward-thinking, innovation-oriented mindset, that would allow us to actually do a lot more. To your point about efficiency, we've forgotten the role that efficiency has played in getting us to this point where, throughout the 2000s, our electricity demand, if not for efficiency measures, would have just continued going through the roof with the internet, with growing population and growing load across the country. But it was energy efficiency and investing in efficiency that brought the peak demand to a more reasonable flat rate. So if we lose and forget the lessons of the past and just, build out our grid infrastructure without considering how we can squeeze more juice out of our current system, then we will run into affordability challenges that are already coming to the fore, but will be even more important. So it is incumbent on regulatory bodies and regulators, the people themselves, to make sure that we're holistically considering all of these factors.
Yeah.
And my worry is that the commissions are just not necessarily well-equipped to do that right now, given their current structure. They're under-resourced. They perceive themselves as lacking the statutory authority to do things, even though they have a lot more power than they often realize. And that we need advocacy ecosystems that are more conducive to pushing regulators in the direction of a lot of the things that we're talking about here.
Yeah, you're deep into this. When you're mentioning that we want them to, the commissioners and the commissions to be able to be more bold, use that word.
Yep.
How do you get that? How do you do that? Are you writing that into their operating statutes, or Or how do you, I should let you answer the question. How do you enhance more bold behavior on these commissions part?
Well, you know, I'll give you a couple examples of specific issues with our current regulatory system. For instance, just on the statutory authority of public utility commissions, they, in most states, in about three quarters of states, decarbonization is nowhere mentioned in their set of mandates. It's just the affordability, reliability, and safety piece. And then if you're concerned about equity and distributive outcomes, distributive fairness, that's in even more states not mentioned as part of the authority, because these PUCs were set up to be economic regulators to make sure that rates were as low as possible. The problem is that the set of societal challenges that we face and that PUCs have some level of authority over are much more complex than in the early 1900s when we created these statutes. So there are things that legislators can do, state legislators can do, to revise the statutory authority of public utility commissions to require them to consider, for instance, decarbonization and equity in all of their decision making. That's something that more states could be doing. I'll give you just one more example. Integrated resource plans and integrated resource planning, which refers to the process by which utilities propose their capital expenses over the next several years to meet rising or forecasted electricity demand. 30 states have IRPs, and a quarter of those states with integrated resource plans don't give their public utility commissions any authority to approve or reject those plans. So you go through this whole process where you have hundreds of utility employees, dozens of PUC staff reviewing these plans, only for it to be a largely casual, I should say, informal in some ways process, because they don't have the legal authority. The PUCs don't have the legal authority to do anything about them. So that's another kind of regulatory tweak that we're talking about here that more states should look at adopting.
This is perfect. Every conversation we're having or every answer is sparking off more questions for me. But this is perfect. You've talked about revising statutes. You've talked about making sure the integrated resource plans are effective at the commissions where they're being, or in the states. But now, is this what Power Alliance is going to do? Are you going to be advocating for those things, or where do you start, Charles? It sounds like you got 50 commissions across the country. Yeah, they've got a lot of leverage, but where do you, as an organization, how do you prioritize and how do you dig in?
It's a great question. I think as an organization that was launched this year, in many ways, we're entering into this conversation, not just in a vacuum, but with all of those converging factors that we're talking about in mind, particularly low growth, right? The big tech companies, the growth of manufacturing and domestic manufacturing facilities has really turbocharged this energy transformation by virtue of the fact that we were gobbling up more and more electricity. So we're entering this moment in that conversation, and everybody is recognizing just how unique this moment is, that we haven't faced this in a couple decades, including the utilities, including the regulators, including advocates. So it's a very unique window for us to be able to come into this broader utility and energy landscape and try to figure out where we can make an impact. And I would argue that, you know, some of the places that I think where we can add value to the conversation are those that are most intensively consumed by this issue of load growth. It's a national issue, to be clear. We're seeing pockets of load growth across, you know, the West, across the Southeast, across even New England and the Midwest. So it is really a national issue. Where we're particularly interested in entering this conversation in is finding those regulatory bodies that are open-minded about addressing these load growth challenges and figuring out exactly how they can push for the whole suite of solutions that we're talking about. Anything from looking at the distribution system and how we can unlock more juice out of that system through distributed energy resources, virtual power plants, demand response, you know, through aggregating different electric technologies like heat pumps, electric vehicles, rooftop solar, as well as on the transmission side, both building out new transmission infrastructure as well as leveraging more grid enhancing technologies to get more capacity out of our existing system.
Are you targeting in certain states? I mean, is it Massachusetts, New York, California, or are there specific commissions that you see are at that tipping point where you could really kind of create the models that I think the rest of them would follow?
Powerlines as an organization, we're starting off by focusing on more of the templates that can be applied in any state, the things that any state that's motivated on these issues can be doing, and understanding what some of those gaps are. So that might be, you know, a framework for how commissions can prioritize the different issues, whether it's VPPs or grid enhancing technologies, et cetera, and helping them understand how to do that, as well as some of the kind of more general tools, a PUC 101 type set of tools and resources for different advocates and legislators across the country to use to understand the role that they play in this architecture. But in terms of specific states, I think we are still in the process of identifying those specific geographies, and we would prioritize ones where there's an existing set of an existing vehicle for some of the PUC modernization efforts that we're talking about, whether it's recent commission inquiries or commission-led rulemaking on certain policies. There's a lot of examples of this. Like, for instance, many states have introduced VPP legislation, or many states have initiated rulemakings on energy burden and energy affordability challenges. So more so building off of the momentum of some of those states with existing vehicles is where we're trying to focus at the start.
Yeah, it sounds like really identifying those best practices, celebrating them, amplifying them, helping to replicate them. What about NARUC? I used to be on the Energy Conservation Subcommittee. I was representing the Colorado Public Utilities Commission and my commissioner Ron Lair, and NARUC seemed to be a great avenue for that sharing of best practices. Is that in your sights as well?
Absolutely. We go to the NARUC conferences, and NARUC can be a important vehicle to, I think the most important function that they provide is convening power, is bringing public utility commissions and bringing people and experts across the country together. And so we are, you know, engaged at the NARUC conferences and with a lot of commissioners who also participate in NARUC. At the same time, you know, I think what we're trying to particularly focus on is, to the point that you brought up earlier, identifying the best practices from different states and different PUCs and deploying them at scale, and understanding how we can promote the lessons that we're learning from how certain states are, you know, incorporating energy burden metrics into their planning to make sure that low-income customers are protected during the energy transition, or how other states are looking at distribution system planning to make sure that we have enough infrastructure in place on the distribution grid to withstand a lot of this growing electricity demand that we're talking about. So being able to serve as a translator of those best practices and spreading them at scale is something that we're very eagerly looking to do. There aren't very many venues for that. NARUC is one of the few venues where that currently exists.
Yeah, and then out of my tenure at NARUC, formed RAP, the Regulatory Assistance Project. I don't know if you're familiar with those guys out of the state of Maine. And then my friend David Moskowitz started that up, and Peter Bradford. And their intent was to, I think, to take best practices state to state. I don't know if they're still happening. But Charles, I think you're an incredibly eloquent spokesman for this. And, you know, within a few minutes, you made it very clear to me that, hey, that this utility regulatory structure is outdated. Like you said, we've never had to deal with decarbonization and climate change. There's the equity dimension of the utility sector now has gotten, I think, you know, a proper attention. Years ago, I used to say in California, there's 1,000 power plants in California, right? And now we've got all these distributed energy resources feeding into the grid. And I want to get your read on vehicle to grid integration, because it seems like that could create millions of participants in the grid. And again, this is something that the PUCs and the commissioners have never had to deal with, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's another trend that I didn't highlight up top in this conversation, but is really exciting. And that's this idea that people can be prosumers, energy prosumers, producers and consumers, where they can generate their own electricity and consume it. And there's different models of this across the country. There are some models, you know, one of the most popular buzzwords that has now emerged is VPPs, virtual power plants, which refers to the aggregation of distributed energy resources. The two most common models for that is one where the utility owns the assets. We're seeing that in, for instance, Green Mountain Power, Rocky Mountain Power, and other utilities. The other is third-party aggregators that are bidding into wholesale markets. So those, you know, VPP companies include ones like Voltus, even Sunrun is becoming a quote-unquote VPP company. And what you're talking about here in terms of vehicle-to-grid integration is just an example of that, where if you have an electric vehicle, whether that's you as a homeowner with an EV in your house, or whether that's, you know, you're a city or a school district or a fleet with a bunch of electric school buses, that's really exciting that the energy, when you don't need it, you can store it in your vehicle as essentially a storage system and then send it back to the grid or consume it depending on what you need at any given point in time and what the grid may need at any given point in time. And if the grid needs are such that, you know, you can export it back onto the grid and be paid a certain amount that is even more valuable to you than if you were to consume it at that time, then you might just think about shifting when laundry or when you cook.
I just wanted to ask you a couple personal questions because lots of people are curious about this. Our listeners are numerous and they are always giving me feedback, which is very useful. But I'm curious how you got into this space. And, you know, did you grow up in Wisconsin? Am I reading correctly?
That's right.
And then went off to Harvard. How did Harvard influence your path?
Oh, it greatly influenced my path. I was very fortunate to be exposed to just incredible thought leaders in the space. A lot of practitioners would often come through Harvard. Harvard does a great job of connecting students with, particularly if you're self-motivated and want to take initiative, opportunities in the quote-unquote real world to connect with folks that are working on these issues in practice. That's anything from different speaker series that they had. And so I was just exposed to a range of climate and energy issues. I remember I had a chance to speak very briefly with Senator Joe Manchin about permitting reform and about the Inflation Reduction Act. It was only, you know, about a minute or so, but it was still just a great experience. Or Congressman Carlos Cabello on how to get Republicans on board with climate change. Or Gina McCarthy, who, you know, has been on this podcast about negotiations during the Inflation Reduction Act. It was just an incredible opportunity to be able to learn from a range of folks about these topics.
And leadership. Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, I must congratulate you and bring this up on the podcast because I was terribly struck by it. I've read that your peers at Harvard stated that you are the most likely classmate to become U.S. president.
That's true. That's true.
And my follow-up question is, first off, congratulations. That's a heck of a distinction to get from a bunch of classmates at Harvard. But Charles,
well, that's how you know that there's fake news these days. So.
Yeah. All right. Would you say you're on track to achieving this aspiration? I think you are. You got an awful lot going on. What do you do for balance in your life? You're obviously putting a lot of energy. You've been in the Biden administration, in the Loan Programs Office. You've been an Aspen Institute fellow. You've been at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory doing research. You founded Power Lines. How do you maintain balance? Are you biking or doing Tai Chi or running or meditating or what do you do?
Well, I'm a big sports fan. That's probably my go-to outlet. Growing up in Wisconsin, I'm a huge Packers fan and Badgers fan, although the Badgers aren't doing so well nowadays, but and the Bucks with Giannis. So I consume a ton of sports, watch sports, play sports. I listen to podcasts a lot, both energy and non-energy podcasts. I like photography. I like taking trains, and I like traveling a lot and hiking. So I try to stay active both in terms of my my professional work in the energy space, as well as in my personal capacities, to always be doing something. It's I kind of get a lot of energy from that. So
I guess so. Good for you. Good for you. Hey, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for educating our listeners about what you're doing and the need for this regulatory reform, and for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it, Charles.
Thanks so much for having me, Ted, and thanks for all the work that you do to connect your audience with all these important topics and discussions.
Appreciate it. Have a great day. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.